Thank you, class of 2012, members of the Board of Managers, Maurice Eldridge, Rebecca Chopp. Had I known what the temperature would be like today, I would have assigned a different text to be read, would have assigned Doug Adams on the importance of bringing towels. Every traveler should bring towels. So it is a great honor to think that you believe that I have something interesting and important and meaningful to say to you at this time, and I will do my best. But looking at you, let me first reciprocate the honor and paraphrase to you and to your families the blessing of Odysseus upon seeing the wonderful and youthful Nausicaa, Odyssey, Book 6. If you are human, one of the mortals living on earth, your noble parents are thrice blessed, and thrice blessed your brothers and sisters too. In their hearts, they must glow with pleasure for you. Congratulations to everyone here, students and families, on your incredible accomplishments. This is a special year for me, a year when I too will be graduated from Swarthmore, and thus a year of reflection. A few decades ago, as mentioned, I left Wesleyan University as a double major in biology and religion. When I announced this double major to my parents, my father immediately replied, "So you're going to be a moil." That's about right. The only profession that could combine biology and religion was ritual circumcision. Little did I know at that time that this combination of majors would send me to places like the Vatican, Jerusalem, and Kyoto. I could not predict then that my scientific field, embryology, would go in directions that would bring me into arguments and conversations concerning cloning, stem cells, abortion, and evolution. You've been hearing for years that you can never know how you will use your liberal arts education, and I can tell you that's absolutely true. Now, I profess embryology, the science of how one's bodies are made, a science that is at the center of those debates on stem cells, abortion, evolution. Moreover, it is a science that seeks to answer questions such as, how did I come into being? How does sexual union create a new organism? How come I look like my parents? How come I have only two eyes, and they are both in my head and nowhere else? How did my front and my back become different? How come some people have penises and others can have babies? What traits of mine are learned culturally, and which ones did I inherit biologically? How am I like and how am I different from other animals? Why can't I grow back my hand like salamanders do? How do my muscles become attached to my bones? I am fearfully and wonderfully made, says the psalmist. But what is it to be fearfully and wonderfully made? How does one respond to this wonder and the yirah, fear, awe of one's body? So today, I'm going to go back to the sources of these questions, wonder. I'm going to make some hypotheses today concerning wonder and the relationship of science and religion. Now, embryology is a profession where wonder remains an operative category. Reviewers of embryology textbooks will write whether or not they think the book under consideration has captured the wonder of development. Wonder is actually expected in the teaching laboratory, and it is used as a motivation to learn the science. The French embryologist Jean Rostand said it very well when he wrote, "What a profession this is, this daily inhalation of wonder." As an embryologist, I'm privileged to experience wonder daily and to expect to be amazed when I enter the laboratory. For many of us, though, wonder has become something we experience only on vacations or as a surprise. I would contend that wonder is a primary experience, the result of the mind encountering the universe. But only mystics, perhaps, can live in a state of perpetual wonder. For most of us, wonder has a short half-life and rapidly decays into two lesser but powerful components, awe and curiosity. This is clearly seen in our language, where wonder has both these meanings. Curiosity is seen in the English expression, I wonder. Awe is seen in our declarations of the wonder of the world. Awe and curiosity both originate from wonder. From curiosity comes the quest for truth about the physical universe and the testing of ideas against other ideas and against experience. That is to say, from curiosity comes the foundations of philosophy and science. From awe come the reverence and gratitude that are characteristic of the religious attitude. Science and religion, let me hypothesize, both descend from wonder. We see this genealogy of from wonder in fragments, and I'll try to put them together. First, let's look at the path to science. Plato and Aristotle both agreed that wonder is the beginning of knowledge. Echoing Plato's Theaetetus, Aristotle notes, "For it is owing to their wonder that men both now begin and at first began to philosophize." At the beginnings of modern science, Francis Bacon, no friend to either Aristotle or Plato, reaffirmed that wonder was the seed of knowledge. Statements of wonder are not uncommon in the autobiographies of contemporary embryologists. However, one of the most important statements of wonder in embryology is from the medieval rabbi and physician Maimonides, who writes in 1190, "A pious man of my time would say that an angel of God had to enter the womb of a pregnant woman to mold the organs of the fetus. This would constitute a miracle. But how much more of a miracle would it be," he continued, "if God had so empowered matter to be able to create the organs of a fetus without having to employ an angel for each pregnancy." Indeed, my job, my career, is to discover some of the ways by which ordinary matter, whether divinely created or not, can form itself into an organized embryo. It's absolutely amazing. The biologist and poet Miroslav Halab, in 1990, said, "Between the fifth and tenth days, the lump of stem cells differentiates into the overall building plan of the embryo and its organs. It's like a lump of iron turning itself into the space shuttle. In fact, it is the profoundest wonder we can imagine and accept, and at the same time, so unusual, so usual, so every day, that we have to force ourselves to wonder about the wondrousness of this wonder." Yet, I write about the molecules, the cells, and the processes by which the embryonic stem cells interact with their neighbor cells to create the precursors of the brain, heart, skin, and guts. The knowledge of how this wonder takes place does not diminish it in any way. Rather, in an incredible positive feedback loop, it makes the process even more wonderful. "The amazing thing about mammalian development," writes embryologist Veronica Van Hengen, "is not that it sometimes goes wrong, but that it ever succeeds." So wonder can give rise to curiosity, which promotes the theorizing and testing that is science. Wonder can give rise to knowledge. But knowledge is not wisdom. Moses, Jesus, Siddhartha, and Muhammad would have failed the SATs. None of them knew the number of protons in a carbon atom or the four bases of DNA. Knowledge is critically important, but it cannot pass for wisdom. Wisdom is how to use one's knowledge to lead a righteous life. It's the framework of the mind, not its furniture. Awareness of the divine, writes Heschel, begins in wonder. For wonder generates not only knowledge, but wisdom. He continues, "The beginning of awe is wonder, and the beginning of wisdom is awe. Knowledge is fostered by curiosity. Wisdom is fostered by awe." So here we have part of the genealogy from wonder. Wonder can generate awe and curiosity. From curiosity, one gets knowledge. From awe, one can get wisdom. Commenting on the numerous times in the Bible where awe is pronounced to be the beginning of wisdom, Heschel claims that awe is the primary requisite of the religious attitude. Awe, he says, precedes faith It is at the root of faith. Now, the Scottish philosopher and essayist Thomas Carlyle similarly viewed wonder, not faith, as the basis of worship. Now, according to this perspective, awe is the principal attitude of the religious person. Thus, one can affirm the following lineages from wonder. Wonder gives rise to curiosity and awe. Curiosity can give rise to science and philosophy. Awe can give rise to religion. Surprisingly, then, science and religion, instead of being antagonistic enemies, find themselves to be close relatives, cousins, grandchildren of wonder. Any fights between them are within the family, not between aliens with separate genealogies. So what do we do with this newfound family? Here again, Heschel helps us by stating the question in a stark existential manner. Quote, "It is not a sense of awe, wonder, or fear which is the root of religion, but rather a question of what to do with the feeling of the mystery of living, what to do with awe, wonder, and fear. Moreover," he warns, "as civilizations advance, the sense of wonder declines. Humankind will perish not for want of information, but for want of appreciation." The problem, then, is twofold. First, why doesn't our civilization recognize wonder? And second, how do we respond to wonder? The answer to the question partly derives in the discipline that the notion that the sense of wonder is diminished by our disciplines. There is in Western thought a fear of wonder and its power. Philosopher Mary Jane Rubinstein has documented that one of the West's most important philosophical projects has been the internalization of wonder into philosophy, making wonder itself an object explainable by rational thought. Wonder may have been the font of knowledge for Aristotle, but he claimed that after it initiated curiosity, wonder would then be dangerous, preventing one from rationally realizing the better state of knowing causes. Similarly, René Descartes and Francis Bacon saw wonder as a passion that precedes knowledge and which must be quickly jettisoned after initiating the quest. To them, the rational control of the wondrous was a source of power. And in religion, wonder quickly is replaced by theology and piety. So one important project, one that is visible in some areas of biology and religion, is to take wonder seriously and to realize that it is becoming endangered. It cannot be assumed anymore. Indeed, according to the model that I'm presenting, both science and religion depend on wonder and will perish without wonder. So science and religion should be allies in preserving the sources of wonder. At the present, we have three enormous sources of power in our society: science, religion, and economic profit. As long as religion and science remain enemies, money will win. It will create technologies out of science for the pollution of the planet in the name of progress. It will create theologies that conflate a person's worth with financial worth. But imagine a series of real alliances between science and religion. Imagine evangelic Protestants with a serious view of stewardship, allying themselves with evolutionary biologists for the protection of wetlands. Imagine staunch Roman Catholics making agreements with Planned Parenthood to protect the fetus by eliminating phytotoxic chemicals from the environment. Yes, it means dealing with the devil. But let's assume that both creationist Protestants and maybe agnostic biologists both want their children to see the loons landing on the lake and to know the taste of freshly caught trout. Let's assume that the Catholic archbishop and the physician who prescribes birth control pills both want healthy babies in healthy families. These certainly are not unreasonable assumptions. Such alliances are indeed forming. One recent example taught here concerns the groups mobilizing to stop mountaintop removal coal mining in the Appalachians. Which brings me to another part of the story, the arts. I can't present a whole discussion on wonder in art, but since I'm discussing landscape examples, I should mention here a passage from a book that I read while auditing a course here on landscape painting. At the dawn of Chinese landscape painting, Lu Qi found it difficult to believe what he and other artists had actually accomplished. Quote, "In a sheet of paper is contained the infinite, and evoked from an inch-shaped heart, an endless panorama," unquote. The landscape painting was not just a picture. It was a mysterious creation that expressed the wondrous essence of the cosmos. Another landscape artist, in this case, the photographer Ansel Adams, wrote, "Both the grand and the intimate aspects of nature can be revealed in the expressive photograph. Both can stir enduring affirmations and discoveries, and surely help the spectator in the search for identification with the vast world of natural beauty and the wonder surrounding him." The arts have a role in transmitting wonder and even in creating wonder. The seven wonders of the ancient world were not natural ones. They were artistic and engineering marvels. Transmitting and creating wonder are not the sole roles of the arts, nor are they the sole roles of science and religion. But these purposes of creating and transmitting wonder are found at the origins. I bring this up because the fight against mountaintop coal removal would not have been a global issue. It would have remained a local issue were it not for the artists, the filmmakers, the painters, the writers, the musicians who brought the scientific and religious messages to the public. So science and religion have a common origin in wonder, and the arts play important roles in the creation and transmission of wonder. So now I just want to continue discussing some alliances that could be made between religion and biology and why the liberal arts has to be playing a major role in forging such alliances. Certainly, one has to look at the pluralities of perspectives concerning life. Each of us, for instance, is experiencing right now this amphitheater in different ways. Some of us have been trained to readily see the architecture that recalls classic Rome. Some of us will see a proscenium stage and reflect on the values of performance and ritual in our graduation. Some of us will see a very encoded integration of nature and culture engineered in the garden. Some of us will smile as we enter into this grove of trees and reflect on the semiotics of ancient initiation rites. Some of us will recognize the garnet schist that came near the surface during the building of the Appalachian Mountains a billion years ago, and whose colors the college adopted as its own. Some of us will look at the rhododendrons that are blooming now and notice that they're blooming at the same time that their pollinators have metamorphosed into flying bees, and that the plant's colors and scents enable these symbiotic insects to complete the plant's life cycle. They know that these plants originated in the Himalayas, and that in each flower, the male part makes the pollen before the female part can receive it, thereby preventing self-pollination. The walk leading to the amphitheater is lined with dawn redwoods, a critically endangered tree that was thought to be extinct until a single stand was discovered in China by Huan Chen in 1948. So to appreciate this amphitheater, one should know not only science, but philosophy and art. Not only sociology, but engineering. Alliances and connections. I hope that you are now appreciating the amphitheater in ways that you didn't know before you came in. Several people had to explain this amphitheater to me. And that is why the liberal arts education is so critical. It's the context wherein science, social science, the humanities and arts interact, appreciate, and enrich one another. Thomas Huxley, Darwin's friend and colleague, used a cultural metaphor to argue the relevance of science and liberal education. Quote, "To a person uninstructed in natural history, his country or seaside stroll is a walk through a gallery filled with wonderful works of art, 9/10 of which have their faces turned to the wall." I use Huxley for another reason as well. He was probably the person most responsible for the current paradigm of warfare between science and religion. It was he who popularized the vision of evolution as a gladiator spectacle, and it was he who felt that as an agnostic, He had the right to teach biology at a first-rate university. But in Victorian England, however, he could not teach biology at Cambridge or Oxford without being an Anglican clergyman, for nature was God's creation and only men of God could interpret it. Science was in the service of religion. Huxley used evolution as a way of separating nature from God, and in so doing, helped create and propagate the paradigm of science versus religion. Neither of these paradigms, science in the service of religion or science or the warfare of science and religion, works well today. We need new paradigms relating the offspring of wonder. One such paradigm may come from the mixing of evolutionary biology with embryology. This paradigm changes evolutionary biology from being a strictly competitive process to being a process that integrates cooperation with competition. The living world, it seems, is full of strange alliances. Let me just mention two biological principles. The first is reciprocal induction. This is how bodies are made. The fertilized egg makes many cells. Then these cells interact. They interact in a way to make new cell types that didn't exist before. So the eye is formed by having cells from the brain protrude and touch the epidermis of the head. And when the brain cells touch the cells of the head, the cells of the head become the lens cells, and the cells of the brain becomes the retina. Okay? The interactions occur to create new things. The second principle is mutualistic symbiosis. Here, interactions between two species create new things. So the rhododendron that we see cannot complete its life cycle without bees, and the bee needs the nectar from the rhododendron. Here we see reciprocal interactions on a large scale between adults, and this isn't the only major symbiotic relationship for our rhododendrons. The root cells of the rhododendrons are invaded by a fungus that penetrates these cells. This fungus extends the surface area of the roots, enabling rhododendrons to absorb more water and nutrients. The rhododendron is thus able to provide food for its fungal partner. Reciprocity in embryonic development between cells and reciprocity between organisms. This is the way life is. Now, I want to talk about a parable. Not the parable of the mustard seed, but the parable of the orchid seed. The orchid seed does not have enough nutrients for it to germinate. It's too small, and its coat is too thick for the orchid to germinate. It cannot germinate unless it is penetrated by a fungal aspect. Part of a fungus has to penetrate the orchid seed in order to give the orchid nutrients. The orchid then germinates and provides the fungus with a place to grow and shelter. The orchid will enable the fungus to propagate while the fungus allows the orchid to germinate. This is the way life works. One makes alliances that aid both partners. The medical biologist Lewis Thomas wrote, "There is a tendency for living things to join up, establish linkages, live inside each other, return to early arrangements, get along whenever possible. This is the way of the world." Biologists Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan put it this way when they say that an organism is, quote, "the co-opting of strangers, the involvement and enfolding of others into even more complex and miscegenous genomes, the acquisition of the reproducing other, of the microbe and the genome. That's no mere sideshow, attraction, merging, fusion, incorporation, cohabitation, recombination, and other forms of forbidden couplings. These are the main sources of Darwin's missing variation." And it's not only for plants. I am made by associations. I am made by reciprocal interactions between cells produced by the fertilized egg. I am also made by interactions between me and the world. I am indeed fearfully and wonderfully made. 90% of all my cells and all your cells are bacterial. and they are intimately involved in making us who we are. Mammals don't form their intestines without bacterial help. We don't form our immune systems without bacterial help. We have outsourced our developmental signals to our bacteria. There are salamanders in the crumb that store algae in their reproductive glands, so the eggs become covered with photosynthetic plants that supply oxygen to their egg masses. There are bacteria that determine the sex of some of the insects here. And some mollusks actually transfer chloroplasts from the algal food into their skin and become solar-powered sea slugs. After that first algal meal, they never have to eat again. There is probably no such thing as a biological individual. So evolution is probably more about cooperation than it is competition. Organisms that cooperate best survive best. I am Team Scott Gilbert. I am as much a composite organism as the rhododendron. You may have read Bruno Latour's essay, We Were Never Modern. The biological equivalent is, we were never individuals. Now, this paradigm of interacting entities that form selves by their interactions is beginning to take shape. In the writings of philosopher Donna Haraway, we see an ethic of becoming with, where Deleuze and Guattari meet Darwin and Margulis. Instead of the existential philosophy characteristic of evolutionary paradigm, I against all others, Haraway has a paradigm of I become with and through the other. And biological science says that this is not mere metaphor. Haraway, by the way, was trained as an embryologist, and she relates her becoming with philosophy directly to reciprocal induction and symbiosis. We see this biological paradigm being expressed in certain religious views as well. The notion of an uncentered self becoming with others, of course, had been a major part of Asian philosophy. Indeed, a recent issue of the Swarthmore Alumni Magazine has an interview with former professor Don Swera about this very concept in Buddhist thought. We are now starting to see this concept in Western religion. These strands were always there, but they are now becoming emphasized. The current Pope, writing as Cardinal Ratzinger, noted that in Augustine's parody of substance and relation, quote, the undivided sway of thinking in terms of substance is ended. Relation is discovered as an equally valid primordial mode of reality, unquote. Can it be that Pope Benedict XVI is in agreement with the lapsed Catholic Donna Haraway, who claims that the smallest unit of analysis is the relation? The writings of one of the leading rabbis of the 19th century, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, claim, one glorious chain of giving and receiving unites all creatures. None has power or means for itself. It receives in order to give, gives in order to receive, and finds therein the accomplishment of purpose for its existence. The Jewish toast, l'chaim, to life, is actually in the plural. Chaim is a plural noun. It's two lives. Makes symbiotic sense. Our biology has caught up with the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s theological and ecological vision expressed in his letter from the Birmingham jail, quote, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. So there may be a new paradigm emerging where religion and science can be allies. Interdependency is the way of all flesh. Reciprocal induction, mutual symbioses are excellent models, win-win situations. We can see this historically. Symbiosis is a Greek word. The Latin translation of symbiosis, conviventia, has a very technical meaning. It refers to the coexistence and mutual interactions between the Muslim, Jewish, and Christian communities during the Umayyad rule in medieval Spain when all three prospered. Indeed, today, science and religion will have to be partners in some sort of symbiosis if they are going to preserve wonder and therefore preserve themselves. When we consider how powerful religion is in the affairs of the world and how powerful science is in the affairs of the world, then it is no exaggeration to say that the future course of world history depends on the relationships and alliances between these two centers of power. Such interactions are occurring, but very subtly. While most of the science, religion, news gets centered on the evolution-creation debates, the real action is occurring in conservation biology. I will make a hypothesis that the major arguments for species preservation come not from science, but from religion or morality in general. When you go to the websites for conservation organizations and you look to see why species should be preserved, the scientific answers are often phrased in economic terms of what may possibly be good for humans. But this doesn't get to the heart of the matter. Why preserve the mountain gorilla, the monarch butterfly, the leatherback turtle, the horseshoe crab, the Bengal tiger, or the California condor? What can we get from the Muhlenberg bog turtle that we can't get from the red ear slider? The answer won't be found in science. I hypothesize that the answer is actually a religious, moral, or aesthetic perception that humans should not totally wipe out another species. And I'm glad to see in many of these conservation websites, especially the general ones, one does find non-scientific reasons to preserve biodiversity, curiosity, beauty, and wonder. The NatureServe site is explicit about this. After mentioning wonder and curiosity, this organization asks, does every species have a right to exist? If so, then our call to preserve creation is clear. But even if not, humility in the face of our capacity to despoil land is called for. Two things. First, this very idea highlights the inversion of nature and humanity during the past 50 years. We are being called upon to preserve nature. Nature needs us. Nature's never needed us before. Nature was a source of wonder and terror. It is now perceived as weak and needs our help. This is what Bill McKibben, who spoke here earlier this year, has called the end of nature. Not the end of organisms, but the end of this idea of a powerful, sublime, wonder-inspiring, and independent other. Secondly, this site identifies species conservation as a religious, not a scientific idea. So while I'm constantly angry at religions for their insipid attacks against evolution, I'm not all that dispirited when I hear that America is a religious country. The question is how to use that spiritual impulse. I think that the disagreements over the origins of biodiversity are a sideshow. They pale in significance when compared to possible alliances of science and religion for the preservation of biodiversity. Science may tell us that mountaintop mining destroys the habitats for fish and invertebrates. It can tell us that such things may destroy streams, but science cannot say that it is wrong. It cannot make judgment that such actions are immoral or that they are not worth the economic advantages gained by mining the coal. That is the job of religion. To get something done, alliances have to be made. So this is where I will end today, with religion and science being taught at a liberal arts college. Science education at a liberal arts college is a unique thing and a very precious thing. It is a conscious symbiosis with the larger intellectual community, wherein nascent scientists also learn philosophy, religion, political science, arts, economics, and numerous other disciplines. My European colleagues are astounded when I tell them that I teach science to poets, historians, and musicians. This context, though, benefits both science and the humanities. First, as part of this symbiosis, students in the humanities and the social sciences learn scientific methods of data interpretation and acquisition. One of the programs of the Liberal Arts College is that its alumni should recognize excellence in whatever form excellence might take. One of the programs for teaching science at liberal arts colleges is so that its alumni can recognize garbage, no matter how well it is packaged. In these days of official-looking websites, all students can gain much from scientific standards of evidence. And reciprocally, the science student can benefit enormously from the humanities. Physiologist and philosopher Robert Root Bernstein found that among scientists who have made major discoveries, nearly every one of them has been trained or self-trained in the arts. They were not technocrats. They saw patterns. He gave data for the view presented by the pioneering neurophysiologist Santiago Ramón y Cajal that scientific discoveries are made by those who combine science with art and literature. Schrödinger made tapestries, Marie Curie wrote poetry, and Rosalind Franklin, Richard Feynman, and Michael Faraday each painted. Moreover, many of the science students take courses in, have friends in, who are studying religion. And here, religion is not taught as a set of dogmas, but as an inquiry into the meaning of life, death, and society. At liberal arts colleges, science students can see how religion can be admired and respected, not seen merely as superstitious remnants of past beliefs. And students of religion and the other humanities can see science as a creative human endeavor, not the robotic accumulation of new facts. We live in contact zones, zones where different cultures are juxtaposed to each other. Here, students of science, humanities, the performing arts, and the social sciences literally sit at the same table. Commensalism is the biological term for this type of symbiosis. It literally means eating at the same table. It's one of the best parts of Swarthmore College and a model to the world. If a new paradigm is to come into being, you're the people who will probably have to do it. If a new paradigm is to emerge, one that will save wonder, it will have to be generated by people who appreciate, respect, and even understand the other, who can truly become with the other. At Swarthmore, you have participated in the wondrous. You've been fortunate to live here, expecting wonder inside and outside the classroom. May you live your lives integrating knowledge and wisdom, experiencing, appreciating, creating, and protecting wonder. Keep making strange friends and unexpected associations. Thank you.